While astronomy is kind of a poetry, the poetry of science. Look at the pretty picture we get from objects in space, how amazing they are. Some of them look like a piece of art, basically, design made by some gods.
Our Bahamian Overe today is Frank Marchese, a planetary astronomer, senior scientist, and director of citizen science of the SETI Institute, best known for groundbreaking discoveries, including the first triple asteroid system in 2005, which earned him the honor to have asteroid Marchese named after him. He shares his journey of discovery, the effort to make the entire sky in real time, and how building a global network of smart telescopes could be a game changer in the search for non-human intelligence. This is Bay Area Novedades, and I'm your host, Steve Ismas. Frank, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Great to have you here. Well, you're an astronomer, you know, a pretty famous one. First, tell us, what would you say is the most amazing thing about astronomy in general?
Well, astronomy is kind of a poetry, the poetry of science. We have an infinite amount of space to study. We can make an infinite amount of discoveries. And it's also a beautiful science. Look at the pretty picture we get from objects in space, how amazing they are. Some of them look like a piece of art, basically, design made by some gods or something like this. So that's one of the reasons I like astronomy.
Now, how about the discoveries? What do you look for? Or what are some of the things that would be like a highlight for an astronomer to discover?
Well, every astronomer is different, in fact. Some of them can stay in front of computers all their life and never even get out of their office. Some others go to different observatories around the world and explore the world by going to use big telescopes, 3, 4, 8, 10 meter class telescopes. And interestingly, those telescopes are located in amazing places on our planet, like in Chile, in Hawaii, in Canary Island, in Namibia. Those are amazing parts of the world that I personally enjoy visiting and seeing. And that's one of the reasons I become an astronomer.
So you get to travel to those places to basically look through the telescope?
Yeah. At the time, in my time, when I was a student, we had to go there.
Yeah.
Now they invented remote observation, so we don't have to always go there. But we found out that if you really want to build partnership and relationship with people, other astronomers around the world, you still need to go to see them. You need to go to exchange, to interact. So that's one of the reasons astronomy is still a science where people travel more than any other classical scientific studies.
Now, we have the Lick Observatory just down here, maybe an hour away, an hour and a half on Mount Hamilton. Have you been there? Is there something that's part of your exploration or your work?
Yeah, I've been multiple times there. I used to work at UC Berkeley, so we have access to the Lick Observatory. And at the time I moved in the US in 2000, Lick Observatory was testing this new type of instrument. It's a laser beam which creates a fake star in the mesosphere at 100 kilometer altitude. And we use these artificial stars to calibrate the instrument, to make the image better using what we call adaptive optics.
Is it real or is it just a light?
It's a light. Uh-huh. So when you look at the end of this tube of this this beam of light, there is a tiny, tiny star created due to the excitation of sodium, if you want to know the details, in the upper part of the atmosphere.
Wow. Well, please tell us about some of your most amazing discoveries. I know there's an asteroid named after you, but just tell us what are some of the things that you really came up with.
Well, my main research was about building instruments for very large telescopes. So when I started my PhD, it was in Chile on the 4 meter class telescope. And then I moved in the US to use the Keck telescope, the largest telescopes at the time in the world. It's 2 10-meter class telescopes. And we installed an adaptive optic system over there that I use for monitoring the volcanic activity of Io. Io is a very interesting moon, it's orbiting around Jupiter.
It's a Jupiter moon.
Because it's close to Jupiter and also has some kind of resonances with other moons, he's being squeezed all the time, so it gets super warm, so he has a lot of volcanic activity. Mm-hmm. We monitor this volcanic activity continuously from the ground, mm-hmm. we tried, and when I went to Hawaii for the first time, we observed and we saw live one of the most energetic eruptions ever seen in the solar system. An explosion called CERT 2001 now, mm-hmm. an explosion of a volcano on the surface of this tiny moon, which was the volcano has an estimated size of the size of Los Angeles or London, mm-hmm. basically, and it appeared in one day. Wow. So we saw that. That was a kind of an interesting application of adaptive optics, this new technology to observe the solar system.
Now, how about the asteroids, the three system asteroids that you discovered? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that was done in 2005, and mm-hmm. I discovered, in fact, multiple of them after. Mm-hmm. So we can always talk about the first one, where we saw yeah. multiple of these systems. So they are made of a large primary, 100 kilometer typically, mm-hmm. and tiny moons, 7, 10, 20 kilometers, orbiting around this asteroid. Mm-hmm. And at the time, theorists claimed that it was impossible to have multiple moons mm-hmm. around an asteroid. And one thing I love to do in science is to show theorists they're wrong. So as soon as I read this paper that it was not possible to have two moons around an asteroid, I spent some time trying to find those. Yes. And I found them, so they went back to the board, and now they explain how we can have multiple moons around an asteroid. There is kind of a model which is due to the evolution of the asteroid, the fact that it basically is a remain of a gigantic collision between two asteroids, and this is the three fragments basically form after this impact.
So I guess they still spin around the asteroid, just like
but it's
like
more complex than the classical rotation, mm-hmm. because the asteroid itself has a very irregular shape.
Mm. And then you moved to SETI and you worked there. How long have you been at SETI?
More than 15 years.
15 years.
Yeah.
Okay, so now tell us about your work in SETI, but mostly I think probably what our audience is most interested in is that any sign of non-human intelligence, and obviously, you know, it's not proven, it's, you know, because otherwise it would be all over the news, but any minor sign that you mention or discover?
So we have not found yet extraterrestrial intelligence. Mm-hmm. There is claims from people, from institutions around the world that we have seen some weird artifact in the atmosphere or even in the ocean at the moment, mm-hmm. but those are not proof, those are recording. And most of them have been explained by a different explanation than claiming it's aliens. Mm-hmm. I would love to find aliens like that, to be honest. It will solve our problems. We will find life, and we will know that extraterrestrial life exists. We don't. Yes. However, this is not proven, and we would like to basically build instruments to monitor continuously the atmosphere of our planet and to be able to see that. It's coming. There is some project to do this kind of search and to have an ultimate proof of existence of extraterrestrial intelligence if those UAPs are truly aliens technology.
At SETI, it's mainly looking for signals, right? Is that correct? Signals from far away.
So SETI is a search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Yes.
And the place we have here is called the SETI Institute. That's the research institution dedicated to this search. There is different way of finding intelligence, of finding even microbes. You can observe in the solar system planets like Mars, or dig the ocean to analyze the water in the ocean of Europa, or Enceladus, which are moons, but we believe there is an ocean underneath the icy crust. We can explore the caves of Mars. Maybe there is life there. So this is one way.
That would be very primitive life.
That would be very primitive life, microbiological life probably.
Yes, yes.
And that's one of the way and one of the tasks of the SETI Institute is to develop instruments mm-hmm. capable of doing this. So we have 30, 50 researchers doing this. Then we have the search for life by analyzing the lights of exoplanets, planets in orbit around other stars. Mm-hmm. So we know now the universe in our galaxy has, in average, in our galaxy, there is two planets per stars.
In average.
And we know that there is at least 300 million of those planets that could look like Earth in size and also have a temperature close to the temperature of which is compatible with liquid water on the surface.
Yes.
That's a lot of worlds. Yes. So now what we're trying to do at the SETI Institute is to look at those planets, analyze the light, and maybe see the signature of life on this planet. It could be basic life, like microbiological life, or maybe we're going to find something more interesting, such as the light of cities, for instance, or technologies, because technology has a signature, and technology will lead to finding intelligence. And then the third way is to search for technosignatures. Mm-hmm. So this is basically searching for an alien civilization which is using technology to communicate. Maybe they're using radio. Maybe if we listen to the stars in radio, we may see a signals which could infer that there is intelligence there. Mm-hmm. It could be the TV or the radar or something like that. Right. Or it could be also lasers. Maybe the civilization are so advanced that they have created this technology to accelerate gigantic solar cells. Mm-hmm. And they use powerful lasers to do that. So we need to find those lasers. That's the third way, that the search for technosignatures.
We'll talk more about lasers in a minute, but I still remember the time where it wasn't proven that there are other planets, exoplanets,
yeah,
in the galaxy, and now there's so many that we know about. Have these actually been seen, or is more of a deduction that they would be there?
Interesting question. The majority of them are not seen. Mm-hmm. It's indirect detection. Mm-hmm. So either we see the motion, the motion of the mass, due to the mass of the star,
yes,
and the planet together, or we see the shadow of the planet when it's passing between us and the star. Mm-hmm. And there is a few of them that we have seen directly. And in fact, we discovered one of them in 2015 with the instrument called the Gemini Planet Imager that was manufactured, designed here in the Bay Area. And SETI Institute is involved as well as other institutions. 100 researchers work on this project. Mm-hmm. And we have been looking at every bright young nearby stars, 600 of them, and we find a few Jupiter-sized or Jupiter-like exoplanets, mm-hmm, in orbit around them. And in this case, we saw the planet. The first one we saw was in 2015, mm-hmm, a beautiful name of 51 Eridani B, remember that? That was the first exoplanet like Jupiter that we image using this instrument in Chile.
Now, I have to ask you about the protocol. Let's assume that SETI discovers a signal, be it laser or radio, mm-hmm, or whatever, that's in some way artificial. What would you do? What would be the steps that, you know, if you discovered it somehow or someone told you, what are the steps that you would approach this discovery, I guess?
Well, the first thing we will do as scientists is to confirm that this is a real signal. Mm-hmm. And it's not someone playing with a cell phone nearby the antenna or shining light into our instruments. Could be that, right? Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do is to ask our colleagues who operate the same type of instruments to listen or to watch this part of the sky and confirm the existence of this technosignature. So this will take time, probably a few hours, but after a few hours, we will get a confirmation of this. When the signal is confirmed, there will be a record. The signal will be recording continuously and analyzed to make sure it's not coming from a satellite, because we now launch satellite, a lot of them. So maybe this is coming from a satellite or maybe a spacecraft that we have launched a long time ago. So there will be this work to assess and to be sure that this is truly coming from a non-human technology. And that's difficult, to be very honest with you. This is not that easy because radio, they bounce. There is always this weird phenomena. There is always someone who has wearing something that emits radiation, for instance, that could basically make mistakes of thinking that it's an alien's technosignature. Mm. When this is done and it's confirmed that it's not coming from a human and the image, the signal is recorded, there will be a committee that will basically decide what how to announce it. So we have derived a protocol at the SETI Institute, at the SETI, SETI Permanent Committee, mm-hmm. that is being redesigned as we speak. It will be announced probably this year, in 2026, mm-hmm. end of this year. But part of this protocol is to make an announcement with all scientists involved, and also warn in advance the United Nations and the president of the country where the discovery was made.
I see.
And when this is done, everybody will have access to the data, can make their own analysis. That's key, I think. And then we will have people, other instruments, following and tracking this this signal. It may be very boring, to be very honest with you. You may hear, oh, the scientists think they found something.
Yeah.
And it will take a long time for this, maybe we found something, to, yes, we truly found, detected the first technosignature.
Do you think anything like the plot of the movie Contact, which is what made astronomy so famous in the U.S., can has a potential to happen in through a discovery like that? Is that realistic in any way?
Yeah, there is some part in the movie and in the book which is, I think, true. One of them is the impact on humanity at large. When we're gonna know that we are not alone in this universe, this will change the perception of who we are and what we do and how we see ourselves. And this may have an impact on the way people react and behave on a daily basis. Maybe some of us will realize that we'll find basically that it's time for us to accelerate the development so we can go to space and go visit these brothers and sisters that live maybe not that far away from us. It will also encourage politicians, but also billionaires, maybe to invest in science and technology, to build those telescopes or those antennas that will be able to listen to these signals and understand who they are and maybe communicate remotely with them. I'm dreaming, for instance, that we will build, if we find a signal like that, we will build these laser facilities so we can send them quickly information and they know a bit about us. And what I will send something like our ChatGPT. I will send them basically an AI, an LLM, with the instruction of how to put it into their own computer, so they will be able to talk to us by proxy, by talking to an AI that represents humanity. All the questions they will have, they will be able to answer directly to this machine that will mimic us. And hopefully they will do the same. So we'll be able to have communication across the galaxy, even though we are not close to each other.
Now, speaking of AI, AI, of course, is so prevalent today, and there's just so much that is changing the world in so many ways. At the same time, there's the issues of fake information that, or AI content versus real content. How do you address this when it comes to signals or anything else for that matter in astronomy? What's the way to differentiate between real and fake?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because I think we are reaching the point where people will be able to generate fake data and basically flood science with fake observation and then fake discoveries. And I don't think the scientists are addressing this enough. I cannot do everything, so in my case, I'm focusing specifically on astronomy. SkyMapper is a new project that I'm leading, and the goal of SkyMapper is to build a database of activity in space, observations. Right now we're starting with telescopes, then we're gonna bring all sky cameras, and then more and more instruments, and all these instruments, all the data they're collecting will be on-chain, so that means that we will know where they're coming from, who recording them, and we make sure the data are not been altered, are not been modified by someone. So this is important because we will have a resource, a database of data which are pristine and that you can trust. If we lose the trust in science with those fake observations, the consequences will be enormous. Yes. So I'm trying to, the motivation of SkyMapper, beyond the fact that we want to build the biggest network of telescopes on this planet, it's also to make sure that we build a network of telescopes for which you can trust the data.
So the way it works, you would have various locations, various groups, people that would have these telescopes. They're all connected, so they can verify each other in a way, or they, you know each one where the source is coming from. Yeah.
So we are building a device that we call the SkyBridge, mm-hmm. and this device is kind of the node. Mm-hmm. And you can plug your telescope or your sky camera on the node, and this node is semi-intelligent, so it can take observation to confirm that you're a real telescope or not some fake one. And when an observation is being requested from your telescope, it goes through the node that take the observation and then validate the observation, make sure that it's coming from this telescope at this time. And all of this is sent to our network, and basically on a ledger, you will always see where the data is coming from, who took them, and when. So you can validate that.
And this is open to everyone, to amateur astronomers, you know, anyone who wants to participate can have their own telescope and connect to this network.
So if you have your telescope, you can just get the SkyBridge. If you don't have, you can get a telescope and the SkyBridge. The Unistellar Telescopes, my first company, is compatible with the SkyBridge, and that will be the first telescope truly working on this network. And professional astronomers can also plug the telescope on it. Small school, which already have a telescope they barely use, they can basically plug the telescope onto our network. And how do you make your telescope available to the community? You earn basically a token as well. So you basically contribute to the to astronomy, to science, and you earn some money by doing that.
And again, if there's something happens in space, there'll be multiple telescopes that they would see it and you can verify.
Exactly. Yeah. So we are creating an AI-based scheduler that will schedule on the right place, the right time observations. We're also putting on board this device, a system that will analyze continuously data coming from those telescopes or those old sky cameras. And if something passes in the sky, some new thing mm-hmm. or something unexpected, I don't know, it can be an asteroid burning into the atmosphere, a new AP, why not? Yeah. We will have a recording of this event onto our network. And we will also call other stations nearby so they can also observe this event. And by combining those observations, we could derive the speed, the size, the trajectory of this object in the atmosphere or in space.
Well, I would like to ask you about your personal belief in UFOs. We talked to a lot of people, some on this show, who are very convinced that there's civilizations that exist, that we interact with even in some way. They're here on Earth already. And there's a lot of people who claim that they have been in contact with mm-hmm. them. But what's really weird about it is that they don't really have anything to gain from saying that. If anything, they get ridiculed, they may be made fun of, and they still maintain those claims. So we always wonder, why do they do this if it's not true? So I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, I will. This is a lot to unpack in an interview, but...
Yeah.
So first of all, you should always separate the human being to the scientist. And that's very important because people have the tendency to believe that because you're a scientist, you always need to think like a rational person, etc. Some scientists believe in a lot of things that you will not believe. Some of them, like me, for instance, are convinced that there is intelligence elsewhere in our galaxy. And this conviction that I have, I cannot prove it. It's like believing in God. It's a personal conviction, mm-hmm. but it's my driver. The reason for which I'm doing all of this is because since I believe that there is this intelligence elsewhere in this galaxy, I think that I'm not wasting my time by building those facilities, those network to find it. And that's important. You need to always remember that we always need to have more than just the science to drive us. And a lot of scientists at the SETI Institute are like that, in fact. And a lot of astronomers, in fact. Most of them will not mention it, but they are this conviction. So now why some people claim to have seen aliens and we don't believe them? It's not that we don't believe them. It's that science doesn't work on you coming and making a claim. Science works by you making a claim and backing your claim with evidences. And generally what is missing are those of evidences. So the reason I'm building this SkyMapper network is to provide those evidences. If we find UAPs or things floating in the sky that which are unexplained. And when I give the data to my colleagues that can do orbits, I tell them, those are real observations. This is not an observation coming from someone randomly taking a picture of a cell phone and maybe photoshopping it. This is coming from the SETI Institute network, SkyMapper, on the blockchain, traceable, immutable. Those are real observations. I'm telling you that scientists will be way more motivated to understand truly what these things are. Mm-hmm. Are they UAPs? Are they balloons? Are they weird airplanes that we don't know about? We will find out.
Was there something in your career that was a turning point that made you go one way or make you more determined or something that you felt like everything is lost and then you were able to come back and go stronger than before?
I have multiple moments like that, but I will say that when I arrived in the US, I was very excited to be part of this community of scientists and also I was amazed by the fact that this government was supporting science. And I thought I basically reached a place where my life as a scientist will be much easier. But then come the election and Obama has become a president and the Republicans decided they're gonna close the government and they press a button and all my dream was gone. I lost my funding, I lost my team, and I basically have to redo everything. And that's when I decided that I will not depend only on the federal government to do my scientific studies. And that's the reason I joined companies first. I joined a company that built mirrors for astronomy here in the Bay Area. I learned about companies. I learned about how to create a company, how to manage a company. And then I joined Unistella as a co-founder in 2017. And then SkyMapper was formed in 2024. And those companies come from that. We never basically depend on the federal government to do my science because everything can be gone. And yes. This is a good decision. Look what happened like not even 3 months ago. It happened again. And I know a lot of my friends and colleagues that lost their job or lost their funding because of that.
Very interesting. Now, let me ask you about a young astronomer. If we have... There's kids who are interested in astronomy and they probably wonder, how difficult is it going to be for me to discover something or for me to become, you know, well-known or to discover that one thing that no one else has seen? Can you talk about it? And what advice would you give to a young astronomer?
Yeah, this is very interesting because we are truly changing the way we do astronomy. When I was a young student, you basically had to find a telescope or a good computer and do 100 observations and you will find something. That's the way I discovered the first triple asteroid systems, for instance. I observed 100 asteroids and I found one. And then after that, I found a lot of them. So it was basically, at the time, you have to find the facility, go there or take the data, analyze the data, and you were truly doing everything by yourself. Now, young astronomers, they're in a completely different environment. There is terabyte and terabyte of observation taken by those telescopes available, by radio telescope. There is a lot of data that have never been analyzed. One of the best stories I have for that is, for instance, this young student from University of Toronto, who decided he's gonna write a machine learning code to search for signatures, technosignatures, with radio antenna, and he used the Parkes, the Breakthrough Listen archive, which I think is 300 or 600 terabytes, something like that. And he ran his code and he found 8 or 10 signals that nobody have seen. So the young generation, they can basically make way more discoveries than us because they can take advantage of multiple years of observation from generation of telescopes the last two decades that now available and waiting to be analyzed and to be processed and to be understood.
That's a very good point. I think most people assume that we are always up to date with the observations, that everything that has been watched, it's already analyzed, but you're saying there's a lot of data and probably it's going to be more and more data with the observations that takes probably a very long time to analyze.
And we make improving the way we analyze the data.
Yes.
Machine learning, for instance, allow now to do almost real-time analysis of radio signals. 10 years ago, you have to grab these observations, store them, 20 terabytes of per hour or per minute, I forgot, and then run a supercomputer to analyze it. And maybe 2 months later, you may have a discovery, but then it's too late because the signal may have disappeared. The star is not visible anymore. Now, with these new programs that we have at the SETI Institute with partners, with that provide processing powers that we didn't have, we can do real-time analysis as well.
Now, I got to ask you this because I have recently watched the movie Star Trek IV. It's an old movie, but it shows how, you know, if, and of course, those are not aliens, they're us in the future. But if aliens don't want to make themselves seen, it would seem pretty easy for them to, you know, to make them invisible or have a way to not detect them. Are you, SETI is looking in any way of ways to discover things that, you know, if they were made themselves not available, right, not sending signals, how would you approach that? Is that thinking behind that?
That's a very good question. And one of the problems we have as scientists is that sometimes we lack this imagination to kind of build those instruments that may find that an aliens may be here and we don't see it because we doesn't,
it's
not part of the same, spectrum that we analyze to something like this. So that's one of the reasons we have this artist in residence program. Mm-hmm. Because there is one group of people that can always think outside the box. Those are artists. And it's always good to pair an artist with a scientist. There is a lot of stuff you learn in this interaction. So it, as part of this idea of bringing awareness to different crazy ideas at the SETI Institute, we have this artist in residence program where we have artists coming to us and asking questions like, how can you be sure that you did not miss that an alien is here in this room if you don't look at this signal or this frequency? For me, for instance, one of the impact of the artist I work with was the discovery of blockchain. I have this artist who was basically building a lot of art and put it on blockchain, and he explained to me why it's important for him as an artist, because he knows that this is a unique piece of art and is going to not be modified and so on. And that gave me the idea to use the same technology for science. Mm. So that's the way we do. We try to break this. Yes. Let's do it the same way it's always been done.
Fascinating. Also, you travel a lot. You interact with a lot of groups all around the world. What is your next trip? And how often do you travel?
I travel like every month, typically.
And that's again to communicate and develop relationships with the astronomers.
Yeah, I discovered that the best way to have people interested in being part of your project is to go and meet them.
Yes.
And plus, it brings a lot to me. I understand more the issue of people, for instance. With SkyMapper, we are bringing telescopes in area in the world where there was no telescope traditionally. Countries in Africa, countries in Asia. We brought telescope in Armenia recently, for instance. But even sometimes bringing telescopes in the territory of the north in Canada. We're just starting doing this. Right. So I can be comfortably sitting in my office and being upset because the telescope is not online and not understanding that until I go there, what those communities face. Sometimes it's the lack of power. Sometimes they have something more important to do than to deal with our telescope. Sometimes survival or storms and stuff like that.
Yes.
So by going to these countries, I generally get lecture, in fact, on my arrogance and recalibrate me and put me back to my place. Say, they have a telescope. They're taking care of it. Be patient.
And overall, it's a much better communication, much better, more efficient.
And they see us, and they see who we are and what we want. I'm visiting countries like Armenia, I mentioned Namibia, and understanding these countries, understanding the true nature of the people living there, their desire, and their motivation as well, the political landscape. It's very important as scientists.
Frank, thank you so much for your time. It's been a fascinating conversation. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you for watching another episode of Bay Area Innovators. If you enjoyed this episode and you know someone who should be on our show, please send us an email at sfbay@epochtimes.com. We would love to hear from you. Thank you and see you next week.